This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, and welcome to the History Listen. I'm Rebecca Huntley. In our last program, we launched into the Australian Mallee, that huge, arid and unsung region straddling South Australia, Victoria and New South Wales. It's vaguely where they all meet. Producer Mike Ladd has been touring the area for 18 months, and according to him, it's amazing and it's mesmerising. In today's program, he focuses on the people of the region. Here's Mike Ladd and Mallee Voices.
I think it gets in your blood, the Mallee.
The people try things. They try new things. Their game. And it has mostly worked for them. The people who have stayed on those farms, the families who have survived from one generation to the next, they're still there. And my mother was a great one for saying the Mallee looked after the people who looked after it.
Open spaces, unpredictable, challenging. It's sort of got a bad name, like it's looked down upon and we get bad publicity and bad press and, you know, or even in the Mallee sort of thing. But a place that gives you a great sense of achievement.
I am 18 in May. I love the community. Everybody knows everybody and, yeah, that's what I love about the Mallee.
Oh, we ran wild. We were very, very blessed. We used to go rabbiting in the middle of the night. And we especially loved it when we caught a fox and we sold the skins in Toolibuck. Fox skin was worth $20. That was like, oh, that was just like some kind of a winning the lottery.
The Mallee seems to breed a certain sort of character. Unassuming, sometimes taciturn, but also resilient and egalitarian. 93-year-old Merv Schneider grew up in the Victorian Mallee and now lives in Nil. He remembers with great clarity going to school in the Depression era.
I was born in Wimmera in 1925. I started school when I was four. And two neighbours were older girls I had, one each side of us, and they took me to school. I can still remember that, one in each hand. I wasn't too keen to go to school. My classrooms were pretty barren, really. I was a left-hander, but those days you weren't allowed to write left-handed. So every time I picked up a pencil to write on the slate, I had my hand hit with a piece of dowel. It was pretty severe. They taught by discipline and fear. Until 1938, we got a new teacher and it was completely different. He was understanding, he was gentle, and my schoolwork just took off. Having started school when the Depression came, there was a lot of underprivileged. The farmers were doing it hard, so they had soup supplied. I think a couple of times a week, there'd be soup brought to the school. I was a bit fortunate. My family wasn't that badly off, so I was well looked after. But a lot of them weren't getting the nourishment they needed, so they relied on the government-supplied soup. Some of the land that the soldier settlers took up was overworked, and there's a lot of dust. And there'd be occasions where a teacher would say, pack your books, go for home as quick as you can, because the dust, and it would go almost as dark as night. And that happened on many occasions at school.
He witnessed something Steinbeckian, a kind of Mallee Grapes of Wrath.
Wimmerling was a railway town, and in the Depression years, people were trying to get from the city to Mildura to pick fruit. And it was shocking. They would clear the train with rubber hoses, detectives they were called, clear them off the train, leave them in Wimmerling, they'd back the train out to get up speed, to come through the town, so that they couldn't jump back on and out the other side. But there was another hill, and it would slow down. So the guys would be there trying to get back on while the train was moving. And we witnessed a fellow went under the wheels and lost his legs. Yeah. People won't believe it, that happened, but it happened. So these poor guys, we'd be left in Wimmerling, small population, and they would come around, "Can I have a sandwich, missus? A cup of tea, missus?" Yeah. The farmers had it tough. Their wheat was sold by what they call wheat scrip. The buyers would come and they would collude with each other to offer prices to the farmers when they bought their wheat by wagon. And I witnessed that as a boy. We would go down to watch, and I saw actually seen farmers weeping because of, you know, the toil, the work they'd done, and the price that they were offered. So, and it wasn't long because they could not meet their commitments, and the government brought in what was called a debt adjustment, where their debts could be honoured by paying shilling in the pound or 2 shillings in the pound, and that would wipe their debt off. And that's when business people felt it, and that's when my father came unstuck. He ran a motor garage. He carried a lot of them for a long while, but there was an end to that till the bank manager came, and he just said to my father, "Phil, well, we're foreclosing. You can't carry on trading the way you are." And so that's when it hit us. So that's when my life changed. That's when one of the reasons for coming back to Nil was Dad came back here to get work, and I came here to high school.
After high school, Murr fought in the RAF in Borneo in World War II, came back to Nil, married, and ran a garage for 53 years.
I worked till I was 70, and my family said, "Dad, it's time you give us a bit of time." So I thought, well, I suppose this time I should knock off. So I did. I think the difficult times in the Depression years and the difficult farming times, we got to depend on people, and the friendships were deep and lasting.
Joan Bennett comes from a pioneering Mallee family.
I was born and grew up on the wrong side of the netting fence, the rabbit-proof fence. It goes through the country north of Nil, and that was the land they said wasn't worth saving. My father had direct experience of rabbit plagues. His father pioneered the Mallee up in the Walpiup district at a little place called Tutty. By that stage, he'd set up a kind of home made out of super bags. So it was pretty basic living when my father went up there as a child, but he went to school up there, but he also helped his father clear land because they were given green mallee blocks. That's what they were, that nothing cleared. My grandfather happened to be a champion axeman. He'd won competitions down in the Ballarat area. So he knew how to use an axe, and my father and uncle did too. But the worst part was the food came out from Oyen on the Walpiup line once a week. So they'd have to go to the train to collect their meat supplies, which Dad called jerky, but it was a kind of a salted mutton, I suppose, or beef. But my father always said that the food didn't quite last the week. So that's when they shot rabbits. But the other thing they did was they had a round of mallee hens nests in that area, and the boys would go around every Sunday and raid the mallee hens nests when they were working. And they only took the pink eggs because they were the fresh ones. From a very early age, I went with my father when he was working in the paddock. Had a W30 tractor. We didn't have horses after we left Turriff, so in 1938 we had a W30 tractor. and it had a wide, wide mud guards, plenty of room for me to sit on. Now, I did that because I wanted to. I've never recovered from the smell of the earth when it's turned over. Fresh. And I have a great passion for the value of the soil, looking after the soil. I don't put much emphasis on the fact how much of it I own, because we're only stewards for a very short time. And we have to leave the land in a better condition than when we got it. That's what our family is like, that commitment to the soil.
In high school, Joan boarded at MLC in Melbourne.
I won a scholarship at MLC, which would have given me free university education at the Conservatorium of Music. But I went home, and I had three brothers at home. My mother was fairly glad to get me home, and I didn't have any encouragement to accept it, so I didn't accept the scholarship. I stayed home. But I got involved immediately. I was just turned 17 at that stage. I got involved in community things. Now, it's one thing about the Mallee is that people support each other in, well, always, but they're great community people. They're proud of what they get. You know, we were proud of our school at Berewillick. Now, it's a ruin. And only the trees that we planted have survived.
Joan travelled overseas but returned to the Mallee, married a farmer and devoted herself to organising cultural life in the community. Now she watches a new generation of her family work the land.
One granddaughter manages sheep, and I think they've got 6,000 ewes and plus other sheep. Now she's managing that enterprise and she's 21 years old.
Author of Mallee Tracks, Jill Nichols, shows me a 1931 photograph of a picnic beside a salt lake. Dressed in summer whites, some local ladies and one man pose with five camels among the native pines. The camels belong to a man named Anwar.
It was out at the Pink Lakes, and it was quite an interesting place to go, particularly in the summer, when there's not so much water there and the sun's going down, it's this beautiful pink. And many, many years ago, they were harvesting salt off the Pink Lakes. And so they used to get camel teams, which they brought in from Broken Hill in the 1920s. And they brought them in so that they could actually transport that salt out to the railway line. And Anwar was one of those camel drivers or cameliers.
Anwar's shack was on the shores of the lake. In stunning heat, his skin pickled, his eyes sunblind, he packed bags of salt, half a ton per load, onto his camels' backs.
And it was in February 1935 that his family home on the shores of the Pink Lakes, and probably wasn't a very palatial home, but it was a home, was burnt down, and two of his children were killed in that fire, which was very sad. And not only had he lost his children, but he lost all of his worldly possessions, and they had 50 pounds of savings in the home as well. So it was a big loss.
Screams, frantic hands, black ash drifting out over the salt lake.
But the local Underball community rallied together to assist that family in true Mallee spirit. And despite the depression, it was during the depression, they collected £30 from the locals in donations and also gifts of furniture, clothing and many other things that this family needed. And so they all joined together on one Sunday, and they built them another home. So it's a good story. It was a sad story, but it's a lovely story as well.
At times old-fashioned and sentimental, at other moments sublime. One of the most enduring Mallee voices belonged to Australia's version of a peasant poet, John Shaw Neilson. He died in 1942, and as far as I can tell, no recordings of his actual voice exist. But we have his words.
The blue wren in the hop bush. His home is in the wild hop in brown and lemon green, and all the orange followers of gold that come between. He often says, to mock me, "How slow of soul are you?" And he puts into the broad sunshine his melody of blue.
Shaw Neilson had barely 2 years of education. His mother taught him to read, and the only books his family owned were the Bible and the poems of another farmer, Robbie Burns.
His life was almost unrelentingly menial in the type of work that he did. It's recorded in the biographies of Neilson that he said quite casually on one occasion that he had over 200 employers in his life because he moved from town to town, even from one gully to the next, in road mending gangs or working as a roustabout or, you know, hard physical labour. And no matter how hard he worked, he always only seemed to ever be able to make just enough money to scrape through. But there's no sense of bitterness or resentment in Neilson's poetry, certainly not about his own life. If there's any sadness, it's perhaps that, you know, the love that he constantly sang about was a love that was either fleeting or just out of reach.
Shaw Neilson has always attracted me because he captures the essence of the Mallee, the essence of the beauty and the birds and the quietness. He doesn't denigrate the people because they're not well educated, they're poor, they're everything else. He sees the beauty in their souls because it's sincere. It's coming from a man who has seen the hard times, the few good times.
The red cow is out on the rushes, the old swans nearby. They see all the turns in the weather, the scowl in the sky. The land is all buckshot and sorrow. It cries like a prayer. The rubble it writes in the cutting grass. Famine is there.
The colours in his poetry were intense. The white burst, the good green, the honey gold, the ripening red, the smoke blue. Counterintuitively, perhaps this was because his eyesight was so dim. His poor vision meant he was forced to dictate most of his verse to whoever was available to write it down for him.
I remember getting some treatment from an Indian oculist at Sea Lake. He put some little pellets, made of curry, I think, into my eyes. And of course, the treatment did no good whatever. I had to knock off reading altogether. For 12 months or more, I never looked at print. I had to get my sister Jessie to do all my writing for me.
And green. Green was his colour above all, because it was as precious in the Mallee as rain.
It has the green of goodness at the glow, proud as an emperor of the elements. It is the bird that will not see the woe. It has the stammering of the held-up brain. It has the hint of old magnificence. It is the bird that rides above the pain.
He thought up his famous poem, The Orange Tree, when he got a job weeding an orchard near Merbein in Victoria.
The young girl stood beside me. I saw not what her young eyes could see. A light, she said, not of the sky, lives somewhere in the orange tree.
Always for him there was some numinous thing just out of reach, like a vision on a sweltering road, like the young woman he loved but couldn't marry because she was Catholic and he was dominated by his fiercely Presbyterian mother, as well as being painfully shy and hopelessly poor.
Her dad selected at nil instead of Minimay. Perhaps our fortunes would have been better. I certainly would have gone to school earlier. Dad got a contract for fencing soon after we landed. We had just 30 shillings and one cow when we arrived. Mother remarked that we had just exactly the same amount when we arrived at Minimay 8 years earlier.
There's irony and sorrow in that he himself was axeman to the trees he loved. Sure, Nielsen is all birds and flowers and light, not out of city romanticism, but through lived experience in the Mallee back blocks and on the road gangs.
Green earth and water have gladdening out of their cry. All things with white merriment do they purify. I dream that they bear to the dead the thoughts of the living. The birds go by.
Sean Nielsen spent his youth in the Mallee nearly a century ago. But what's life like for young people in the Mallee today? 18-year-old Lexi Thomas lives on a farm near Pinneroo, South Australia.
I have one older sister who's studying medicine in Melbourne, so I don't get to see her as much as I would like, and I have another sister in Canberra, so I don't really get to see her as much as I'd like either. No matter what I decide to do, I think I will go to uni, which is a bit of a shame because it means leaving home, but it's the choice you've got to make. It's a lot different to what it has been in the past, especially in my dad's generation, where a lot of people didn't finish year 12 because they went home to work on the farm. And that's definitely changed. I mean, all of the guys in my class have finished year 12, for instance, and I think one of them will stay on the farm. I think that they'll probably take up a trade, and you know, that means they might still stay in the area once they've learned that trade, but it's a similar thing again to probably what the girls will be doing, coming back with a trade maybe, something that they can use. So I'm not sure exactly what I want to do, but I know something in the health field. But I suppose it depends what jobs are available. And one reason that I wanted to do something in the health field is that I know there's a big shortage of health professionals in rural areas. So I want to eventually live rural again because I just love it, and I can't see myself living in a city for the rest of my life. I suppose one tricky thing for me is that being 18, I could only get my license a couple months ago, so I couldn't sort of drive around to a friend's place or, you know, get into town whenever I could. I sort of had to rely on mum and dad for that, which they were great about, but it does make things more difficult. So that distance, it's pretty quiet. There's not necessarily much for a young person other than sport. You know, there's not like much music or any of that kind of stuff for a young person. You know, I've heard stories of people being around drugs. Luckily, I haven't actually, you know, experienced seeing that myself. But I think it has changed the culture a little bit, and whether that's because people are getting bored and there isn't much to do at night, I don't know. But yeah, I think most people I know are aware of how damaging it can be. So I think that they're more aware of that, which might make them less likely to do drugs.
Sean Mallee farms have grown bigger and more mechanised. Fewer people are needed on the land, and that means it's harder to keep schools, hospitals and shops open in Mallee towns. Ty Richardson grew up on the family farm at Pabinga, then became an artist.
A stencil artist I was, so a very sort of urban style graffiti. Quite a different sort of style to take up in the country, but yeah, a lot of chance to experiment, yeah. Everything from the old pop art style work to pin-up work and portraits.
Now he runs the Pinneroo pub.
You put in the hard work and you hope that it comes back to you. I think we are, like, unfortunately, a lot of country towns on a decline, but I think Pinneroo is quite unique in that it's at a much slower decline than other country towns. Like, you'll see throughout Midwest Victoria, there's not much left of a lot of the country towns throughout there. Pinneroo, the local butchers, the same age as me, the hairdressers, only 21 years old. A lot of youth back into the basics of the community of having shops and businesses and stuff like that to run. Yeah, which is great to see.
The challenge is to find new activities to support the region, and this includes tourism. Across the Wimmera and Mallee, there's a growing tourist trail of photorealistic art on wheat silos, featuring local people scaled up to gigantic presences. Beside the Mallee Highway, I meet Community Arts Officer Nat Traeger.
We are in the Mallee in Knowpen, and we are looking at a magnificent visual of five local school children which have been painted on the Knowpen silos by artist Guido van Helton.
After a solid month's work on top of a cherry picker and using only standard spray cans, Guido has made the local children 30 metres high.
The thumb of one of the kids on the front is larger than the painter himself. So to put that into perspective for your listeners.
Before, hardly anyone stopped in Knowpen. Now one car per minute pulls up to take a photo of the art on the silos.
It's changed the face of this town, which was very much struggling. A lot of its businesses had been turned into residentials, and the business which is just across the road from the silos hasn't been open for 30 years, but it's now a brand new silo cafe.
Hopeful signs. Now, one more poem to finish this edition of the History Listen. Les Murray takes us to some Mallee shows of the past, when Jimmy Sharman's boxing troupe beat the step-up drum.
What year was the very best Mallee show? When Lord Hopeton attended that bottled year? When Skewthorpe danced his horse for some peer? Lord Brassicai, or was it Brassy? And Sunshine Harvesters turned into Massey? No, what year I need to hear? When the Wallop Pipe Band piped music and rum, and Jim Sharman's pokes beat the step-up drum, and ladies dressed up their skills and turn, or dress for each other or themselves alone, when the ticket strung through the tweedy eye of each member's lapel meant pedigree. What year? It was every year. After the last, they made a past. The ring events, the Wyandotte hens, the marble cakes in their ribbon pens. What year was the greatest Mallee show? When Warwick Nabil yachts sailed on Lake Glue, bagging needles flew and girth straps strained. The best show was any year it rained.
Mallee Voices was written and produced by Mike Ladd, with sound engineering by Tom Henry and music by Jakub Gardaczynski. Check out our website if you'd like to see that silo art, and join me, Rebecca Huntley, next week for a year in the life of a little Mallee town called Mantung. Thanks for joining me on the History Listen. Bye for now.